Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. And all the lines are full right now. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And you know what, Jimmy? I saw there was news, and it's related to something you have talked about on this show, and I don't think anyone else has talked about, is that document that came out, the Vatican document on kind of how to proceed when there are claims of apparitions and supernatural things. And now there's some news based on that from Medjugorje, and I think that's what a lot of people have been waiting for. So can you kind of run us through what that's all about, what was said?
So first of all, for more information, I wrote a piece about this for the National Catholic Register. They asked me to do a piece on it for them. So you can read that for more detail. But basically, what I suspected might happen did happen. After the announcement of the new norms for evaluating reports of private apparitions, they took the Cardinal Fernandez was asked if, you know, they were going to do Medjugorje. And he said at the time, well, I haven't reviewed that material yet, but we should be able to proceed to a decision now. And even though one of the now seven categories for classifying reports of an apparition sounded like it was tailor-made for Medjugorje, he kind of went in a different direction. He raised the possibility of giving it what's called a nihil obstat, which means nothing obstructs the faithful from having a devotion to this, but with some clarifications. And that's what they did. So a nihil obstat is now the highest ruling, the most positive ruling that can be given to an apparition without the direct intervention of the Pope. What a nihil obstat does not do is pass any judgment on, is this genuinely supernatural or not? The Vatican has not made a ruling on, are the reported apparitions at Medjugorje supernatural? In fact, at the conclusion of the new document on it, they say that three times. So they really want to make it clear, we're not saying whether this is supernatural or not. But they say, you know, a lot of the messages associated with it are wholesome and can be used for devotional purposes by the faithful. And there's good spiritual fruit, you know, conversions and reconciliations of marriages and stuff like that connected with Medjugorje. And so the faithful can have a reasonable devotion here. But there are some clarifications they needed to insist on. And so you can read the article or the original document, which is linked in the article, for more information about that. Basically, it leaves us in the same position that we were in before. People who think that Medjugorje is supernatural can continue to think that, but they've been put on notice by the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith that not all the messages should just be regarded as this is the will of heaven. They specifically say that some of the messages can be misleading or are misleading, and there are some things in them that you just need to not pay attention to. So if you're going to think it's supernatural, don't be thinking it's just this is what heaven says. On the other hand, they say that if you don't think Medjugorje is supernatural, you're welcome to think that too. But they have ruled that there are genuine spiritual fruits connected with Medjugorje, and so you shouldn't be downplaying those either.
All right. And it does seem like that document that came out earlier is working. It seems like that was kind of like a little bit of Drano in the pipe. Like, let's get some things moving, and it's actually getting some things moving.
Absolutely. Since the new norms came out in mid-May, they have now issued 10 rulings on individual reports of supernatural phenomena. So they really have broken the dam on that, and a lot more water's flowing through. They're really proceeding through these at a good clip.
Well, thanks, Jimmy. Thanks for going through it, because I know you have been kind of keeping us up to date on that. As a matter of fact, I don't think I would have even known about it if you hadn't brought it up on the show.
Also, I will be doing an episode of Mysterious World on this, but it'll be a few months before it's out.
All righty. All right, on we go to the phones. Thanks, everybody, for waiting. Matthew's in Greenville, South Carolina, listening on Catholic.com. That's our website, Catholic.com. Matthew, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right. First of all, hi, Jimmy. But
Eddie.
I've been looking through some of these arguments that people try and make about, like, oh, the Bible really doesn't say anything about consensual, loving, monogamous gay relationships. Or the Bible, you know, it kind of endorses monogamy, it implies it, but it doesn't hardcore condemn polyamory. And looking at these arguments from both sides, I definitely really lean towards the idea that, like, the Bible does condemn homosexuality. It does endorse monogamy. But when I hear the arguments from the other side, I can see how someone could maybe potentially try and reach a conclusion. I think there's a few points, but I don't find it very convincing. But what I'm curious is, like, why did the Bible leave any room for an argument at all? Why is there any wiggle room? Like, why didn't Jesus or Paul just blank, black and white say, marriage is between one man and one woman, and not men or two women? Like, why didn't it just lay it out in such a way where there just is no wiggle room whatsoever? Like, no one can make a case for otherwise at all. Like, there's just no ambiguity whatsoever.
Well, I would say it doesn't leave any wiggle room on this question. The way marriage is presented in the Bible, it's always between a man and a woman for purposes of the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. And it indicates that, it doesn't always indicate that it's just one man and one woman. In the Old Testament, they weren't yet at the stage of doctrinal development where they were ready for that. So they had polygamy, which is one man and multiple women. They had that in the Old Testament. But then when Jesus arrives, he makes it clear that God's pattern for marriage is to be found in God's creation of Adam and Eve, which is Adam and Eve, not Adam and Eve and Barbara and Sally. So you have monogamy in the case of Adam and Eve, and that's God's plan for marriage in general, according to Jesus. You also have repeated condemnations of homosexual behavior, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, where, for example, in Romans, at the beginning of Romans, Paul talks about how the Greeks, abandoned knowledge of God, and God gave them up to depraved minds so that they left aside the natural use of women. Notice he says natural, and burned for lust with each other, both men burning with lust for other men and women burning with lust for other women. And so this is clearly presented as an unnatural situation that's contrary to God's love. So I think on any fair reading, there just isn't wiggle room on this. Now, you can try to gin up wiggle room by adding qualifiers that, you know, you could always, even if you produced a passage which, you know, condemned homosexual marriage, you could say, oh, but it didn't address what if you dye your hair purple first. Maybe purple dyed hair homosexuals can marry each other. You know, you can always add qualifiers to create a situation that's not directly addressed in the text. But that such tactics are dodges. And so if you start adding qualifiers like mutually reciprocal love and stuff, you know, on top of the text, you're playing games. It's real clear the text does reject this. On the other hand, it doesn't address every conceivable situation, and that's because this is not a text of moral theology. The Bible is an organic document that's not written to answer abstract questions in every conceivable variation that one could come up with. It's meant to establish basic principles for the life of God's people, and it's written in a particular time and culture, so it reflects the concerns that were present in that time and culture, not scenarios that are going to arise in other cultures thousands of years later. So it's not it you have to take into account the base culture that wrote these documents and what was of concern to them. It's not meant to be an abstract, timeless text. That's why we also have apostolic tradition in addition to Scripture, and why we have the apostolic magisterium that can respond to change in concerns and questions that come up in later ages. So, you know, if you have a text that was written at a particular period, you can all, and you come around, you know, 2,000 years later, you're going to have concerns and questions that weren't envisioned by the ancient authors. And that's why we need the magisterium to help apply the principles that are in our original sources in an accurate way, guided by the Holy Spirit.
Thank you, Matthew. Got to take the first break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
From Rome to your home, EWTN's Vatican Bureau lets you watch all of the important events from Rome, even if you don't have a TV. Using the latest technology, we've made it possible to watch the latest news from the Holy See, all delivered directly to your home. Watch live on EWTN YouTube and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Catholic Answers Live, Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy's got a new podcast. Just search Jimmy Akin Pod. Maybe you should say where people should go for the Jimmy Akin Podcast. I don't want to mess it up right from day one, Jimmy.
Well, you can go to JimmyAkinPodcast.com, or you can go to YouTube.com/JimmyAkin. It's also got a homepage on Catholic.com in the podcast section. But I'd say the simplest way to get there, you can also search for it on podcast apps, because it's going to be on all of them, you know, okay. Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Stitcher and all those things. So it's really up to you and your preferred listening method. But I always encourage folks to go to YouTube.com/JimmyAkin.
Check it out. It's brand new. Just dropped today, right? Is today the first?
No. It was a couple, 3 days ago.
Oh, all
this
right.
is the first time I've been on the show since
gotcha.
It dropped. And it's normally going to be coming out every Monday. If we have one episode a week, it'll always be Monday. If we have additional episodes, they'll appear Tuesday through Thursday.
All righty. Let's go to Charleston, South Carolina. Matt is watching on YouTube. Matt, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, hi y'all. Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Akin, I'm a huge fan of Mysterious Worlds and been heavily referencing Fathers Knows Best recently. So thank you so much for those invaluable resources. They've been an absolute blessing for me. Look, I'm kind of in the midst of a little nod to Stephen Ray here, a recrossing mm-hmm. of the Tiber moment. I feel mm-hmm. pretty spiritually unfulfilled and a little confused. I believe the Lord is kind of calling me back to the Catholic Church where I grew up.
Good.
So my question is a little bit more technical, so hold your britches here. It pertains to Matthew 16:18, but mm-hmm. I'm not asking about the usual interpretation of Peter being the rock. I've already crossed the Tiber on that. But instead, it's more of the use of the term the church, or ecclesia in Greek and kahal in Aramaic. As mm-hmm. you know, ecclesia and kahal primarily denote like a gathering or an assembly of people rather than a hierarchical structure. In the context mm-hmm. of an ancient Greek city-state, ecclesia referred to an assembly of citizens for deliberate purposes, which seemed to emphasize communal decision-making rather than a centralized authority. So given this, is there a theological or historical basis for understanding that Christ intended a structural ecclesial authority, such as the papacy or episcopal governance, when he used the term ecclesia in this passage specifically?
Okay, so kahal is the Hebrew word that corresponds to ecclesia in Greek. I'd have to check what the Aramaic equivalent of kahal is. I'm sure it's a cognate of kahal, so it's going to sound the same, like maybe kehalah or something. But they all three have the same root concept, and that root concept is an assembly. Now they have sub meanings that are based on context. For example, in the Hebrew Bible, kahal is sometimes used for like an assembly for purposes of making war. It's also used more generally for the assembly of the community as a whole. You mentioned a particular use of ecclesia in Greek polises, Greek cities, and I'm not denying that usage. I haven't seen it documented, but it wouldn't surprise me. But what you can't do is go and find one particular usage, like deliberative communal decision making without a leader in a Greek city state. And assume that that's what the author of Matthew, who is a Jew, is thinking when he uses the term. What you can do is look at parallel usages in Hebrew and in later Christian Greek, and there are uniquely religious usages of kahal. And they are not inconsistent with having a leader or leaders in the kahal. That was a standard part of Jewish religious life. You had priests as leaders. You had elders as leaders. You had tribal leaders in Israel. So they had leaders in Israel. It wasn't just, let's all get together and democratically make decisions. That's not how Hebrew society worked. And so we wouldn't expect to read that meaning into the Aramaic that Jesus was using when he taught this. But we don't have to stop at linguistic studies, because we can examine the immediate context. So what happens immediately after Jesus tells Peter, on this rock, meaning you, Peter, I'm going to build my church? Well, that of itself would imply that Peter has a leadership role in this assembly, in this community. But then Jesus goes on to say, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. And I'm sorry, he says, I'll give you the keys to the kingdom. That's a reference to the key that the chief steward of the house of David had. So he's saying, you're going to be the chief steward of my house, the house of the new David. So that explicitly gives him a leadership role. And then he says, whatever you bind on earth is going to be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth is going to be loosed in heaven. And the power of binding and loosing, we know from parallels, like in the Jewish historian Josephus, referred to the ability to establish and modify and abrogate laws for the community. So it's a legislative judicial function. And so this is, again, indicating that Jesus expects his kahal, his ecclesia, to have leaders and laws and judgments and things like that. And it's not simply a democratic, let's get together and debate things and come to a consensus club. We also find other passages in the New Testament that clearly indicate that the Christian church is structured hierarchically. Later, in two chapters later in Matthew, where Jesus refers for the second time in the Gospels to his church, he shares the power to bind and loose with the other disciples. He doesn't share the keys, but he does share the power to bind and loose. And if you read, Acts, we've got apostles and we've got evangelists and we've got elders. If you read St. Paul's letters, we have the same offices with the addition of episcopoi, bishops or overseers. And we have instructions in the New Testament to things like, honor those who are, or obey those who are over you in the Lord, implying a hierarchical structure. So it's really clear that Jesus intended his community to be hierarchically structured and have leaders. That's why he appointed the 12 disciples to be the original chief leaders. So I would say we've got abundant evidence for the idea of the church as a hierarchically structured institution.
Thank you, Matt. I'm going to keep moving. Lines continue full. And off we go to Hayden, Idaho, where our friend Emma is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome back, Emma. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you, Cy. Jimmy, I'm hoping you can unpack what the Pope said about after his Asia, tour, that he said all religions lead to God and we all worship the one God.
Yeah, he didn't say that.
Okay, tell me what he said.
Okay, so this was at his stop in Singapore, and, as normal, when the Pope says something, people rip it out of context and blast it all over everywhere without the surrounding context to make it clear. Basically, now the first thing you got to do is frame this in terms of who's talking. And one of the things we know about Pope Francis is he places a high priority on evangelization. The first document that he issued upon becoming Pope was all about evangelization and the need to share the gospel of Jesus Christ with people. And he's regularly hit that theme. When he reorganized the Vatican, he made the congregation, or now dicastery, for evangelization first, above the one for the doctrine of the faith. So evangelization and sharing the gospel of Christ is really important to this Pope. So you got to bear that in mind when you read the text. So what happens when we read the text? Well, we find out that he sets aside, because he mentions it, he set aside the prepared speech he had that he was going to give to these young people and just talk off the cuff, because he wanted, to make a connection with them. He had things he wanted to say that I guess weren't in the speech, and he wanted to make this connection with these young people. So you got to bear in mind, he's not given a carefully phrased pre-prepared text that's been vetted. And when that happens with Francis, it's often a bit imprecise. So you have to have some generosity and say, what's he trying to say here? Well, when you read the actual paragraph in question, he starts by saying that I admire you young people for your ability to conduct interreligious dialogue. So that's the topic, how to conduct interreligious dialogue. He's not making a general statement in the abstract. He's talking about the proper way to do interreligious dialogue. And he then raises the idea of getting into fights as part of interreligious dialogue. And he solicits an answer from the young people that if you get into fights about, whose God is better than whose and whose religion is more true and stuff, that's going to lead to destruction. So what he's doing is counseling people against having fights when they're doing religious dialogue. He wants it to be respectful and low-key. That doesn't mean you deny your beliefs. It just means you're respectful and peaceful in how you do religious dialogue. And he then says, he doesn't say all religions lead to God. He said all religions are paths to God, meaning they're ways that people try to pursue God. That doesn't mean they're all going to get you to a correct understanding of God, much less does it mean that they're all equal and it doesn't matter what your religion you are. We already know this guy is big on evangelization and teaching people about Jesus Christ. What he's not big on is getting into fights about that or other deities as part of interreligious dialogue. So he's acknowledging a truth that, religions can be spoken of as paths to God in the sense that people walk these paths trying to get closer to God, but that doesn't mean they're all equal or that they're all going to get you to an accurate understanding of God.
Emma?
That makes me feel so much better. Thank you.
Well, we like it when you feel better, Emma. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call. As you've heard me say, the lines are remaining full all afternoon today. So on we go. Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia, where Charles is watching on YouTube. Welcome, Charles. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hey. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Question for you. So I am new to the Catholic faith, came into the church at the vigil this past year.
Congratulations.
And I'm a father of three daughters, oldest is 12, and I am finding myself struggling with catechizing the kids into the faith. So We had been lapsed Episcopalians, hadn't really gone to church for a long time. I love theology. I studied it in school. And so I think I tend to err on the side of being a little too intellectual about the faith. I will go really deep into specific topics with them, and I fear I'm maybe doing more harm than good.
Okay.
So I guess the question for me is, if you can recommend some texts that might help me figure out how do I give them a good, solid understanding of the faith while not boring them or maybe making it seem overwhelming to them?
Well, so I normally work with adults, or at least older teenagers. So I haven't really surveyed the literature on catechesis for younger folks. I know that there are catechetical programs that are age appropriate for different levels. Your parish may well have a catechetical program that you could get them involved in, or a youth group or something like that. I know that Ignatius Press has, I want to say it's called Light and Life, but I could be mistaken. I know it has a catechetical series designed for young people of different ages. You also could look at older catechetical material like the Baltimore Catechism. It needs a little update because of legal changes, but there's a variety. And I would just do some checking online and look for catechetical literature for children by good Catholic publishers.
Thanks, Charles. Got to take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ, September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A little bit of groovy music there for you. On a Friday, I notice, I guess, is it a movable feast, the groovy music? It moves to wherever Jimmy is on. All right, I guess groovy music will be on Fridays now. The number is 888-318-7884, and I tell you that because, stunningly, lines have opened up. We've had full lines all day, and now there are lines open. So if you've got a question you'd like to ask Jimmy Akin, you're welcome to call. As a matter of fact, we'd love it if you'd call. Whether you're Catholic or not, whatever your question is, you're welcome here. 888-318-7884. We're going to Nebraska now.
Actually, I had a note for Charles.
Right in front of me.
Because my answer was a little truncated because the hard break came up.
All right.
So anyway, I was recommending that Charles do some looking around for catechetical materials that are age appropriate for his daughters from good Catholic publishers. And what I would suggest is, I mean, he can have them go through these materials, but what I would suggest is for him to go through these materials. If he thinks he's being too intellectual in his presentation of theology and doctrine to his daughters, see how other people are doing it. You know, look at material that's been specifically designed for the ages his daughters are, and then he can incorporate a similar level of depth and style in his own presentation of the faith to them. So I would suggest not only having his daughters use these materials, but using them himself. And, you know, perhaps even, I mean, if he could enroll them in a catechetical program at church, and or he could study, you know, these materials with them at home. And I suspect it's just a matter of finding the right balance with a little bit of experience and preparation.
Charles, I hope that that was helpful to you. On we go now to Lewis in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Lewis, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay, my question was if there was specific requirement that stated how much of the Mass you need to get to for it to validate the Sunday obligation?
Nope, there is not. And that leads to, yeah, and that leads to a lot of questions about this, because sometimes people are late, or they need to step out for a minute, or, you know, they need to leave early or something. And so people do have questions about this, but what the church has done in the way it's framed the law is not address any of that. And the apparent reason for this, because if you go back in the moral and pastoral literature surrounding the previous rite of Mass, there was some more guidance on this. For example, a common opinion, and I don't know that this was official, but it was a common opinion, was that you needed to be there for the liturgy of the Eucharist. You didn't you could miss the entire liturgy of the Word. They didn't call them liturgy of the Word and liturgy of the Eucharist, but they wanted you could miss all that and still fulfill your Sunday obligation. The final entry point that I've seen in the literature where you could show up and have it be valid was the beginning of the canon, the Eucharistic prayer. But when they revised the liturgy, they just said, we want you at the Mass. They didn't specify how much of the Mass. And presumably, one of the reasons for that is they do want you there if you can make it for the liturgy of the Eucharist. They don't want you ignoring that. It's an important part of the Mass that's received additional emphasis. Also, they didn't want to encourage scrupulosity, you know, so they don't want people really worrying too much about this. If they did want us to worry about it, they'd give us clearer guidelines. And so I think a fair assessment based on the way the law is written today is to say that you should be there for the whole thing unless you've got a reason not to be. And so if you have a reason not to be there for a particular chunk of the Mass, like I forgot to leave in time, and so I'm going to be 5 minutes late or 10 minutes late or something like that. Well, you have a legitimate reason. You're not saying, I'm going to deliberately stay home and miss part of Mass. Or if you need to step out because you got to go to the bathroom, or you got a screaming kid and, you know, things like that. Well, if you got a reason to step out, then you've got a reason to step out and you still fulfill your obligation. So as long as you have a reasonable basis, they want you there for the whole thing. But as long as you've got a reasonable basis for missing some chunk of it, then you can go miss that chunk of it and you'll still fulfill your obligation. And if you have a significant reason for missing the whole Mass, well, then you're excused from your Sunday obligation that Sunday. You know, like if you're sick or need to take care of someone who's sick or things like that.
Lewis, hope that was helpful. Thank you for the question. Now the lines are full again. So back to the calls we go. Calvin is in Michigan, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Hello, Calvin. You there with us?
Yes.
Well, how old are you, Calvin?
9.
Well, thank you very much for your call. We're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Aiken.
If we all have guardian angels, do we get to see them in heaven, or do they go to someone else who doesn't have one yet?
Okay, so the church doesn't have a teaching on this. This is a matter of theological opinion. Both of your questions are matters of theological opinion. I would say that we are very, very likely to get to meet our guardian angels in heaven. I think that's, I have no doubt that we do. That's my opinion. That's not church teaching, but that's my opinion. On the question of do they get reassigned to someone else, well, that's possible, but I'm less confident of that. It's possible that they do. It's even possible that they have other people they're looking after right now. Since your questions deal with guardian angels, I'll recommend an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World for you that I did specifically on people's questions about guardian angels. It's episode 325. And so with your parents' permission, you can listen to it by going to mysterious.fm/325. That's mysterious.fm/325. And you can listen to episode 325, which is all about people's questions about guardian angels. I made it because I get so many of these questions, and so I wanted to create a resource that could benefit everybody.
Calvin, I hope you will check it out. And thank you very much for the call and for waiting on the line. We appreciate that you took the time to do that. We go now to Iowa, where Joe is listening on Iowa Catholic Radio. Joe, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, I was wondering, recently I heard that if a man is impotent and is incapable of consummating a marriage, he cannot get married. I guess I was just wondering why.
Because part of what matrimony involves is giving the other person the right to have conjugal relations with you. And that doesn't mean you got to exercise that right. There are what are known as Josephite marriages, where the parties freely choose never to consummate. That's not very common, but it does happen. And those are considered valid marriages. But in those marriages, there is the ability to have matrimonial relations. Because, you know, let's say you're a man and your wife later changes her mind and says, no, I want to have relations. I want to get pregnant or whatever. She's got the right to have you have marital relations with her. And if you don't have the ability to do so, then you can't fulfill what she has a right to have. And all of this is true if you flip the genders. If a man, you know, is not impotent, but the woman is impotent, all the same principles apply. So this is not based on gender. But what the law says is what invalidates marriage is antecedent, perpetual, and incurable incompetence. So antecedent means it exists before you attempt marriage. If it happens after you attempt marriage, you're still married because you were not impotent at the time of marriage. Perpetual means it just goes on all the time. It's not like, well, sometimes I can fulfill and sometimes I can't. If it's a sometimes I can, well, then you're not perpetually impotent. And so the marriage will be valid. And it has to be incurable, meaning there's no treatment for this, which would enable you to do it at least some of the time. That is kind of going away due to medical advances, because we now have things like, Viagra to help men consummate. And we also, there are penile implants that can help men consummate. And so the incurability of this is largely going away because of medical advances. And so this is applying to fewer and fewer people compared to what used to be the case. But if it's true that one is antecedently, perpetually, and incurably impotent, then you're not able to fulfill one of the obligations of marriage, which is given the marital right to the person you're married to.
And that will bring us right to the break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because it is the food of the saints that we receive. And for the saints, they understood rightly that the time after Holy Communion, that those moments are the most precious moments of our lives.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. For me, it has gone quickly. I realize I am not doing the bulk of the work here, but this has been a very quick 2 hours. Lots and lots of great calls. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. And we're going now to San Antonio, Texas, where Michael is listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Michael, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Hello, Si. Hello, Jimmy. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Michael.
So there's people that argue because God knows everything, we don't have free will. So how do you reconcile God's omniscience with free will?
Okay, so it's interesting that you asked this, because as Si and I were talking, I've just launched this new Jimmy Akin podcast, and episode 1 came out this last week. And it's on what God really wants. And episode 2 is coming out on Monday. And it is on exactly this question. How do we reconcile God's omniscience, including his knowledge of the future, with our free will? So I would recommend that you listen to episode 2 of the Jimmy Akin podcast. And it'll go into more detail than I can at the moment. But to give you the core of the answer, knowledge has nothing to do with other people's choices. Let's keep it in the human realm for just a second. Suppose that you and I, Michael, are in the same room and I see you reading a book. The fact that I know you're reading a book does not force you to read the book. You're reading the book of your own free will. I just happen to know it. Then suppose I hop in my time machine and visit you a year from now. And once again, a year from now, I also see you reading a book. Well, I'm not forcing you to read that book. You're choosing to read that book of your own free will. I'm just aware of it. And if I then come back in time and say, oh, guess what? You're going to be reading a book a year from now. I haven't violated your free will. Nothing I've done forces you to read either one of those books. You're choosing to do that by yourself. This is exactly the situation that we have with God, except God is outside of time. So to him, all times are equally real. He sees what you were doing a year ago. He sees what you're doing right now. And he sees what you're going to be doing a year from now. And so if he sees you reading a book in the present, he knows that. And if he sees you reading a book at a point that's currently in your future, he's aware of that, but he's not forcing you to do either of those things. You're freely choosing it. God's just aware of it. And so that's the core of the answer. Knowledge simply has nothing to do. Knowledge of what other people are doing has nothing to do with forcing them to do it.
All right, great. That was a great response. Pretty funny that that's going to be your second episode. Thanks for that.
Well, Michael, thank you for the call and for the question. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. We're going to Raleigh, North Carolina now, where Marie is listening on Divine Mercy Radio. Marie, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, we know that Jesus's body and Mary's body are in heaven, and most people have, symbiosis with other organisms, you know, a microbiome and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So would that mean that there are critters up in heaven with Mary and Jesus that hitched a ride along?
Okay. Well, so it's true that we do have microbiomes, and in fact, the number of cells in our bodies that belong to our microbiomes is actually larger than the number of human cells in our bodies. This is something we know today, but it's not something they knew in the first century. And so the sources of faith really don't address this question. So this is not a matter of church teaching. It's a matter of speculation. Now, historically, many theologians have been of the opinion that you need a rational soul in order to survive death. And so they would say that, animals at least macroscopic animals like dogs and cats and stuff don't have an afterlife. I think that's a very problematic view. That's also not church teaching. That's just theological opinion. And I did an episode of Mysterious World on that where I went through the arguments for against animal afterlife and concluded they don't work. And I also uncovered some empirical evidence that would suggest at least some animals do have an afterlife. That's episode 203 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. If you want to listen to it, you can get to it by going to mysterious.fm/203. So that answers, I think, part of the question, but it doesn't answer all of it, because even if you said, okay, these microorganisms we've got don't have an afterlife, well, they could reproduce. You know, if so, Jesus, let's say, has, you know, a microbiome, he's got gut flora, and then when he ascends into heaven, the gut flora, unless God doesn't want to bring it, is going to go with him. And even if gut flora has no afterlife at all, they can still be reproducing 2,000 years later. So that's hypothetically possible, even if animals don't have an afterlife. You still got to consider this possibility. I would say that the answer, in forming an opinion on this, the answer would be unclear to me. Because one of the things that Jesus, that the New Testament teaches, is that in the afterlife, we may not need to eat food. There are at least some passages, particularly in 1 Corinthians, where St. Paul says, like, God made food for the stomach and the stomach for food, but he's going to destroy them both, and we're going to have a spiritual body and stuff like that. And that could be read as saying we're not going to eat anymore. It also could, on the other hand, there are other passages that depict heaven as a great banquet or feast with God and the saints. So I think it's unclear whether or not we're going to have whether we're going to eat in the afterlife. It might be the case that we don't need to, but we may do it anyway, you know, for fun and glorifying God and stuff. Well, if we're eating food, then I would say we probably have gut flora, because that's one of the things that's a key component of our ability to digest food is, you know, the gut flora does a lot of the work for that. And that's how we evolved a symbiotic relationship with our gut microbiome. We ingest food, the microbes break it down into things that we can eat, and they also get some of the nutrients of the food. So I would think if we're eaten, then we probably have gut flora in heaven. On the other hand, if we don't eat, we might not have gut flora in heaven. Now, digestion is one of the functions that our microbiome covers, but it's not the only one. We also have a microbiome providing defense of us as an add-on or auxiliary help to our immune system. But we know we're not going to be sick in heaven. So it could be that part of the reason we're not sick in heaven is because we still have gut flora or microbiome assisting our immune system. Or it could be God just renders us supernaturally immune to any disease or injury, in which case we wouldn't need microbiome to be performing that function for us anymore. That wouldn't tell us it's not there, but it would mean that we at least don't need it. So I would say that the answer to this one for me is thoroughly murky.
What do you think of that, Marie?
Oh, it's pretty good. I mean, but you have to admit that you could eat it with a resurrected body, because Jesus ate. So that at least is an indication that something might continue. And there's, yeah. So anyway, but you know, it's just a very interesting question.
It's actually a fascinating question.
It's definite that you can eat, because Jesus did, as you point out. He did though in order to prove to the disciples that he was physically alive, and we won't need to prove that in the next life. So you could propose, well, even though we can eat, we won't, but we may still continue eating.
I have to say, Maria, I really enjoyed the question. I don't remember the question of whether the symbiotic organisms in our bodies would accompany us to heaven. I don't remember. Jimmy, you get a lot of interesting questions. You might remember that, but I don't remember ever having heard it before.
Yeah, no, it's a good question.
Thanks, Marie.
But they're all good. It's just the answers that can be bad.
Rarely, very rarely. Let's go to Elizabeth in Indianapolis. Marie, thanks again. Elizabeth is watching on YouTube. Welcome, Elizabeth. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay. Hello, Cy, and hello, Jimmy.
Hello, Elizabeth.
My question is, are divorced Catholics allowed to receive communion? And then if you have time, I'd love to know your opinion on the apparitions of Garabandal, Spain.
Okay. So just because someone's divorced, it doesn't mean that they're prohibited from receiving communion, assuming nothing else is affecting the situation. Now, if you, like, abandoned your spouse for selfish reasons, you know, without a good reason, you just said, I'm out of here. Well, that was a sin and a grave sin, so you'd need to go to confession. But once you've gone to confession and you've repented, you could receive communion. On the other hand, if you get divorced and you marry someone else, then the church is going to presume that you're still bound to that first spouse, because Jesus indicated that that divorce followed by remarriage is adultery. And so if you marry someone else, or you want to marry someone else, the church needs to look at that first marriage to see, was it valid or not? Are you free to marry someone else? And that's what's commonly called the annulment process. But just being divorced is not of itself in principle sinful, and therefore people who are divorced can receive communion unless something else is affecting the situation. Now, what was your second question?
Well, I know a lot of people have asked about the rulings.
Oh, Garabandal. Yeah.
And I wondered if they said anything at all about Garabandal, Spain.
There have been some lower level rulings on Garabandal that were negative. And so I haven't studied the Garabandal case in detail. I plan to do an episode of Mysterious World on it in the future. And for that, I will dig into it and study it. But my understandings are that none of the lower level decisions that have been announced on it supported it being supernatural.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you so very much. I appreciate it. I really love the show, and I love both of you too. You're very, very helpful in my Catholic life.
Oh, thank you
so much.
That's a very kind thing to say. I'll tell you what, do we have other calls, or should I? I know we have a question from YouTube, and I can get to that question from YouTube, but if there are, I think we got nobody else on the line at the moment to get to. So a question from YouTube, don't have a name for it. Mm-hmm. Via my free will, can I override God's will? Or does this mean I have a limited will, since God's will so clearly trumps my own? If so, I claim that I am not culpable and not responsible.
Okay, so in order to answer this question, you have to clarify which will of God are you talking about. Theologians commonly distinguish between God's preceptive will, which is what he wants to happen, and his permissive will, which is what he allows to happen. Well, so in terms of God's preceptive will, God wants you to not commit adultery. But do you have the ability to commit adultery, to sleep with someone who's married to someone else, or someone that, if you're married, that you sleep with someone you're not married to? Yeah, you got the ability to do that. And in that, you can overcome God's preceptive will. He's given us that freedom. You shouldn't, but you can. What about his permissive will? Well, if he allows you to do something, then you obviously didn't overcome it. So if God permitted you to commit adultery, then you didn't overcome his permissive will. There is, though, a third kind of will that isn't often talked about as much in theology, and that looks at the range of actions that humans are able to do. For example, humans are able to breathe and process oxygen as part of their metabolism. It's God's will for that to happen. And we can do that. But it is not God's will to allow humans to fly without technological assistance under ordinary circumstances. I mean, maybe some saints get to levitate, but humans can't ordinarily fly. But in that, you cannot override God's will. But that doesn't mean you don't have responsibility for choosing good and evil, which is the real issue here.
All right. Thank you to everybody who called and for all the questions. Check out Jimmy Akin's new podcast. You can find it at his YouTube page or wherever you get your podcasts. And Jimmy, thanks very much. Enjoyed those 2 hours.
My pleasure. Have a great weekend.
Hey, next week we're at the conference, so the show will be live. Jimmy will be one of the guests on Thursday from the conference. And if you're coming, looking forward to seeing you. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.